This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We're all driving to the same place. That is a ceasefire that's genuinely durable, that turns into a full cessation of hostilities between the competing forces, and that resumes the very important negotiations that were underway to create a transition to a civilian-led government.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on the international community's efforts to forge a truce in Sudan. Details coming up also. At least 50 members of a Kenyan church are believed to have starved themselves to death. And a Zimbabwe conservationist takes a new role to help protect wildlife. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Dozens of countries scrambled to arrange transportation to get their citizens out of Sudan amid concerns that fighting could escalate and cut off exits from the country. The death toll has surpassed 400, with nearly 4,000 people reported injured, and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the situation is worsening and could engulf the entire region. The exodus of foreigners included a nighttime pullout of U.S. diplomats and other personnel Saturday, a week after the fighting erupted. The U.S. also closed its embassy in Khartoum. In a news conference today with Kenya's Secretary of Foreign and Diaspora Affairs, Dr. Alfred Mutua, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington backs African-led efforts to end the fighting.
We strongly support African-led efforts to help both mediate this crisis, to end the hostilities, and, as I said, get back on track to transition to a civilian-led government. We participated in, I think, an important meeting by video conference that was convened by the chairperson of the African Union, Mr. Faki, at the end of last week, that included the Secretary General of the United Nations, that included virtually all of the stakeholders in Africa and beyond who have an interest in trying to help Sudan get back on track, and we continue to support those efforts. We all have the same goal. We're all driving to the same place. That is a ceasefire that's genuinely durable, that turns into a full cessation of hostilities between the competing forces, and that resumes the very important negotiations that were underway to create a transition to a civilian-led government.
In the United Nations Security Council today, Guterres said the UN is not pulling out of Sudan, but it has temporarily shifted some personnel and their families to other locations in the country or in the region. He said the repositioning will allow UN agencies to continue aiding civilians. Residents hunkered down with rapidly shrinking food and water supplies, along with power and communication outages. Zahara Nahomuza is a Ugandan medical student in Khartoum. She says students are sheltering at the university.
And the embassy officials, they have really rendered as much support as they can. They have kept our hopes high. They have assured us that we shall work on an evacuation once there is a ceasefire between the two parties. And if they confirm that there is a safe airspace that has been secured and an evacuation corridor has been created to safely evacuate the Ugandan nationals that are here in Sudan. So in case there is any failure of this evacuation, definitely we'll be left with no other choice because we cannot stay here to die. We'll have to take the risk of moving to other neighboring countries, maybe Egypt, maybe Ethiopia, so that we can book flights that can lead us to our final destinations in our homes.
Nahomuza also offered reassurances to the parents of the students, saying they are staying safe, far from the fighting. Those who managed to escape told horrific stories of constant threats from clashes between Sudan's army and the paramilitary group headed by military men who once cooperated but had turned into rivals. Other countries with the resources to act on their own quickly followed suit. Many European nations and the European Union have evacuated hundreds of staff. Josep Borrell, the EU foreign policy chief, described the evacuation effort.
I cannot give you the concrete figure, more than 1,000 people for sure. I want to thank France especially for taking our people out. And I want to thank the combined efforts of many countries that took their nationals, but also all nationals that they could pick. So it has been a successful operation, but complex. I was in touch with the two generals fighting in Sudan. And now the ceasefire has stopped, it's over. We have to continue pushing for a political settlement. We cannot afford that Sudan, which is a very populated country, implodes, because it will be sending shockwaves around the whole Africa.
You will find frequent updates on the Sudan crisis on voaafrica.com and in all our news programs. As countries rush to evacuate their diplomats and citizens from Khartoum, Sudanese nationals are fending for themselves amid power blackouts and loss of internet service. Sama Salaman is a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that as fighting between two rival factions continues, some Sudanese have decided to take to the dangerous road in cars and buses to escape.
As of this morning, from my relatives and friends and sources in Khartoum, what we're hearing is that airstrikes are becoming more aggressive. And they're now hitting homes, residences, hospitals, schools outside the center of Khartoum. So whereas many of our friends and relatives had actually moved from their homes in the downtown center of Khartoum to areas 10, 15 miles outside, to areas like Omdurman, for example, even those areas are now being shelled. So no one is actually safe anymore. So those families are now seriously considering crossing the border into Egypt, along with the thousands who have been crossing on a daily basis over the past couple of days, as well as crossing the border into Ethiopia or Chad. So it's a very tragic and horrific situation.
From what you're hearing, how easy is it to cross the borders?
So far, the crossing into Egypt has been the most reliable and accessible way of crossing out of Sudan. So it's not difficult. It's a very long journey. There are lots of checkpoints. There's also the threat of being attacked by either side on the way there. There are several stops. So the journey is actually almost twice as long as it normally would be because of the fact that they have to reroute and move away from areas of potential airstrikes and also away from the military bases as well as away from the RSF bases.
There have been ceasefires declared and none of them has held. How do you see this situation ending up or improving?
Unfortunately, none of the ceasefires have helped. None of the pleas to open up humanitarian corridors have been heeded. And that's even more worrying because the fact that the two sides are so aggressive and so charged means that this is becoming a battle of egos. I mean, the fact that they are not even heeding responses to children who are injured and need medication, people who are actually forecast to become hungry over the next 2 to 3 days. So we're seeing a serious possible shortage of food and a hunger crisis that could emerge and unfold in the next 2 to 3 days. And I think that, you know, from speaking to some of the humanitarian organizations, the only possible way that they could access could be food airdrops.
Given that this is a complicated conflict, what do you say to those who say maybe other countries may be meddling into the situation, making it worse?
Well, I think that certainly there are reports that General Haftar in Libya is supporting Hemeti with arms, and I think this is definitely making it worse. It's exacerbating the situation. We know that Russia's Wagner Group has for a long time supported Hemeti and the RSF with weapons and military training, and what this has done is actually create a proxy battle between the U.S. and Russia in Sudan, and this is really serious as both, you know, the U.S. and Russia fight for hegemony in Africa. We see the Gulf states such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE support Hemeti. We see Egypt with a long-standing, very strong relationship with General Burhan and Sudanese armed forces supporting al-Burhan. And so what you have right now is a situation where the regional support of the two actors is actually making the conflict even more violent because it's creating a very large flow of arms into Sudan. And the risk of this is not only this flow of arms into Sudan, but the spillover of these arms into neighboring countries that are also very fragile. For example, South Sudan with its own militias, Chad with its own militias. Chad has actually closed its borders for fear of the spillover of these weapons and movement of militia fighters between through the borders, very porous borders between Sudan and Chad. Ethiopia also has its own war and its own conflict and risks the spillover of weapons into Ethiopia. So you have a very, very, very complicated situation with many, many, many actors. And this makes the Sudan conflict, the Sudan civil war, not only a national conflict, but a regional conflict, and also a staging ground for international actors and their own proxy wars in Sudan.
That was Sama Salaman, a Sudanese strategic analyst and president of the U.S. Educated Sudanese Association. She spoke with Douglas Mpuga from the U.S. city of Boston. As the rush to get embassy personnel out of the Sudanese capital to safety continues, one analyst says the writing was on the wall that the leaders of the army and the paramilitary rapid support force would turn on each other. Russia has wanted naval access to Sudan's Red Sea ports. The United Arab Emirates paid RSF leader Hemeti to help fight in Yemen, and Egypt has supported military chief al-Burhan, sending troops and warplanes to the country. Did the United States play a role in the crisis by not working harder to make sure the framework peace agreement would hold? VOA's Carol Van Dam put that question to Rebecca Hamilton, professor of law at American University, a former Washington Post correspondent in Sudan, and the author of the book Fighting for Darfur.
The role of the U.S. is distinctly different from the role of the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Egyptians, in that for the most part, the U.S. interest is in seeing a stable, democratic Sudan. Now, we can certainly have a long conversation about the ways in which the US has tried to secure that and the multiple failures in terms of pushing for rushed peace agreements that are effectively just power sharing deals between men with guns. And what the Sudanese people have asked for, and that no one in the international community has ever really supported, is a truly inclusive peace process that brings in the marginalized communities, that brings in the women, that brings in the whole of Sudanese society, because that process is something that diplomats are not really trained to do. They're trained to bring together whoever has the weaponry, sit them in a hotel room and sort of bash heads together until they get signatures on a piece of paper that divvies up the power, and then the diplomats say that's success and leave.
Well, that's a problem. I mean, if it's laid out like, you know, you say, then we sort of are guilty. If we go in a hotel room with these two generals and the other military types and say, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. We'll give you this, we'll give you that, you know, but you've got to agree with us and get them to sign on a piece of paper, then we sort of are guilty. And as are some other Western nations, if we really didn't look at the long term and knowing these two are going for power, did we make a mistake?
So 100% I agree, and there is plenty of blame to go around in this situation. I still would maintain that it is different to, for example, the Emiratis supplying weaponry to Hemeti, who has a proven track record of being a war criminal. He is responsible for the atrocities in Darfur. So it is a different kind of blame to go around, but certainly plenty of guilty players here. And yes, I think at the end of the day, the failure of everybody involved here is to listen to what the Sudanese themselves are saying. The neighborhood resistance committees, which are Sudanese civil society, largely youth driven, that were really the backbone of the revolution that overthrew this 30-year dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, they are the ones that we should be listening to. that if we're really serious about democracy, then what they are calling for is what needs to be supported. And that is a long, hard and messy road. And that's why the tendency of external actors is to look at these committees and say what they're asking for is unrealistic and they need to be more pragmatic. But to be honest, at this point, whatever everybody else has been pushing for hasn't worked. And so maybe it is time to listen to what the Sudanese themselves are saying.
That's Rebecca Hamilton, professor of law at American University. She was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam in Washington. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhibi in Washington. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Kenyan authorities have recovered at least 50 bodies of members of the Good News International Church who are believed to have starved themselves to death. Police Monday rescued 29 members of the church in a forest near the coastal town of Malindi. The death toll is expected to rise as the Kenya Red Cross says 178 members of the church were reported missing. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
Kenyan security forces and residents of the coastal town of Malindi continue to recover the bodies of people who starved themselves to death after following the teachings of Good News International Church Pastor Paul Mackenzie. Kenya's Inspector General of Police, Japhet Kaome, said an additional 11 bodies were exhumed from Mackenzie land in Shakahola Forest on Monday. He said 29 people were rescued. Japhet Charo lives in Furunzi, the village where Mackenzie preached to his followers. He says the community is saddened by the senseless death of their members. There is sadness in everyone, not just those who went to church, but also those who did not, Charo says. They are upset about this whole situation that we have never seen or heard. People are wondering what kind of benefit a situation like this brings. The pastor said children will die fast, followed by mothers and men. He says, we're not sure how such deaths will benefit him. Pastor Mackenzie was arrested more than a week ago after four of his followers died of starvation, thinking it was a way to meet Jesus, according to reports. Authorities have recovered a total of 50 bodies from Shakahola Forest since then. Charo began attending Pastor Mackenzie's church in 2006, a year after it opened. The father of eight says he knew Mackenzie when he was a taxi driver in the late 1990s. And will frequently wash his vehicle for him. The 44-year-old left the church in 2017 after his children began to follow his anti-school teachings and refused to attend classes. There were rules in the church that women had to cut their hair and not wear makeup, and he encouraged children not to go to school because there was nowhere in the Bible that said children had to go to school, he says. When it came to that kind of teaching, I noticed some political games being played in the church and decided not to attend, Charo says. Kenyan President William Ruto said there was no difference between the pastor's actions and those of terrorists.
What we are seeing in Kilifi, in Shakahola, is akin to terrorists. There is no difference between Mr. Mackenzie, who pretends and postures as a pastor when in fact he is a terrible criminal.
Families continue to search the forest for their loved ones, according to the Kenya Red Cross, which assists with rescue and psychological efforts. The number of missing people has increased. Hassan Musa is a Kenya Red Cross regional manager for the Coast region.
We still have 178 people missing, according to the records that we have. Meaning that we also are also working very close with the government and other stakeholders to see if we can be able to identify these other missing peoples. So what we are doing again is because of the overwhelming numbers of cops, so we are working very close with the county government to see if we can enhance capacity for the morgue. And what we are doing is to see if we can have a mobile morgue so that it can accommodate the numbers that are actually increasing day by day.
President Ruto has directed security agencies to monitor the activities of religious leaders who promote dangerous ideologies. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
In South Africa, the government has evicted more than 100 refugees who had camped outside the offices of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Pretoria since May 2022. They are demanding to be resettled in another country and say the Southern African government failed to protect them from recurring violent xenophobic attacks. Tuso Kubalo reports from Pretoria.
The eviction process in Pretoria started early Friday morning with the sheriff of the court reading out the eviction order to the refugees. The order said they should either cooperate and be moved to Lindela Repatriation Center or be arrested and sent to prison. Lillian Nyota Kakuku, mother of four from the Democratic Republic of Congo, told journalists why they no longer want to seek refuge in South Africa.
I served this country. I worked in this country. Everything that I made in this country have been looted by the citizens of this country. Right now, more than 20 years, I have nothing.
The municipal government of Pretoria, or Tshwane as it is now called, sought the eviction of the refugees' camp, saying it posed a health hazard because it lacked sanitation and water. When some of the refugees refused to live on their own, the police forcefully evicted them. State Attorney Kobus Meyer explained why.
They have refugee status and therefore they need to reintegrate into society. The problem is for some reason they do not reintegrate into the society. So the court order is saying they need to vacate this area.
Gerard Freemail, an official from the Tshwane municipality, described how the evictions ended.
All in all, 10 people have returned or have voluntarily decided to return to Lindela Repatriation Centre by the Department of Home Affairs. 6 people were arrested for being illegal immigrants, and the rest of the group have vacated the area voluntarily.
However, Louis Duplessis from the Lawyers for Human Rights asked the Department of Home Affairs to have a sober discussion with the refugees.
I think it would have gone far if the UN was more involved in this process and at least attended some conversations with them. I think it might have made a difference if the UN played a bigger role. I know they're also limited in what they can do, of course, but they are the custodians of the refugees.
The refugees also accused the United Nations High Commission for Refugees of failing to protect them as required by its mandate. The UN body, which earlier said it has no power to transfer the refugees to another country, said the evictions were carried out peacefully. Its statement said the families were free to come and go out of the repatriation center as much as they desire, as there were no plans to deport them. Reporting for VOA News in Pretoria, I am Tuso Kumalo.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Beckford, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.